That lit up Desi's eyes.
Oh,
was all he said, the sound of someone who spied a surprise firework. It strikes me as odd, Nick, that you'd come here and ask Desi about his relationship, or lack thereof, with your wife, Jacqueline Collings said. Are you and Amy not close? I can guarantee you, Desi has had no genuine contact with Amy in decades. Decades. I'm just checking in, Jacqueline. Sometimes you have to see something for yourself. Jacqueline started walking toward the door. She turned and gave me a single twist of her head to assure me that it was time to go. How very intrepid of you, Nick. Very do-it-yourself. Do you build your own decks, too? She laughed at the word and opened the door for me. I stared at the hollow of her neck and wondered why she wasn't wearing a noose of pearls. Women like this always have thick strands of pearls to click and clack. I could smell her, though. A female scent. Vaginal and strangely lewd. It was interesting to meet you, Nick, she said. Let's all hope Amy gets home safely. Until then, the next time you want to get in touch with Desi? She pressed a thick, creamy card into my hands. Call our lawyer, please.
Amy Elliott Dunn, August 17th, 2011. Diary entry. I know this sounds the stuff of moony teenage girls, but I've been tracking Nick's moods. Toward me. Just to make sure I'm not crazy. I've got a calendar, and I put hearts on any day Nick seems to love me again, and black squares when he doesn't. The past year was all black squares, pretty much. But now, 9 days of hearts, in a row. Maybe all he needed to know was how much I loved him and how unhappy I'd become. Maybe he had a change of heart. I've never loved a phrase more. Quiz. After over a year of coldness, your husband suddenly seems to love you again. You, A, go on and on about how much he's hurt you so he can apologize some more. B, give him the cold shoulder for a while longer, so he learns his lesson. C. Don't press him about his new attitude. Know that he will confide in you when the time comes, and in the meantime, shower him with affection so he feels secure and loved, because that's how this marriage thing works. D. Demand to know what went wrong. Make him talk and talk about it in order to calm your own neuroses. Answer, C. It's August, so sumptuous that I couldn't bear any more black squares. But no, it's been nothing but hearts. Nick acting like my husband, sweet and loving and goofy. He orders me chocolates from my favorite shop in New York for a treat, and he writes me a silly poem to go with them. A limerick, actually. There once was a girl from Manhattan who slept only on sheets made of satin. Her husband slipped and he slided, and their bodies collided, so they did something dirty in Latin. It would be funnier if our sex life were as carefree as the rhyme would suggest. But last week we did fuck, do it. Something more romantic than have sex, but less cheesy than make love. He came home from work and kissed me full on the lips, and he touched me as if I were really there. I almost cried, I'd been so lonely. To be kissed on the lips by your husband is the most decadent thing. What else? He takes me swimming in the same pond he's gone to since he was a child. I can picture little Nick flapping around manically, face and shoulders sunburned red because, Just like now, he refuses to wear sunscreen, forcing Mama Mo to chase after him with lotion that she swipes on whenever she can reach him. He's been taking me on a full tour of his boyhood haunts, like I asked him to for ages. He walks me to the edge of the river, and he kisses me as the wind whips my hair.
"My two favorite things to look at in the world," he whispers in my ear.
He kisses me in a funny little playground fort that he once considered his own clubhouse.
"I always wanted to bring a girl here, a perfect girl, and look at me now," he whispers in my ear.
2 days before the mall closes for good, we ride carousel bunnies side by side, our laughter echoing through the empty miles. He takes me for a sundae at his favorite ice cream parlor, and we have the place to ourselves in the morning, the air all sticky with sweets. He kisses me and says this place is where he stuttered and suffered through so many dates, and he wishes he could have told his high school self that he would be back here with the girl of his dreams someday. We eat ice cream until we have to roll home and get under the covers. His hand on my belly, an accidental nap. The neurotic in me, of course, is asking, "Where's the catch?" Nick's turnaround is so sudden and so grandiose, it feels like he must want something. Or he's already done something and he is being preemptively sweet for when I find out. I worry. I caught him last week shuffling through my thick file box marked "The Duns," written in my best cursive in happier days, a box filled with all the strange paperwork that makes up a marriage, a combined life. I worry that he is going to ask me for a second mortgage on the bar, or to borrow against our life insurance, or to sell off some not-to-be-touched-for-30-years stock. He said he just wanted to make sure everything was in order, but he said it in a fluster. My heart would break, it really would, if, mid-bite of bubblegum ice cream, he turned to me and said,
"You know, the interesting thing about a second mortgage is..."
I had to write that. I had to let that out. And just seeing it, I know it sounds crazy. Neurotic and insecure and suspicious. I will not let my worst self ruin my marriage. My husband loves me. He loves me, and he has come back to me, and that is why he is treating me so nice. That is the only reason. Just like that, here is my life. It's finally returned.
Nick Dunn. 5 days gone. I sat in the billowing heat of my car outside Desi's house, the windows rolled down, and checked my phone. A message from Gilpin.
"Hi, Nick. We need to touch base today. Update you on a few things, go over a few questions. Meet us at 4 at your house, okay? Thanks.
It was the first time I'd been ordered, not, "Could we? We'd love to, if you don't mind," but, "We need to. Meet us." I glanced at my watch. 3 o'clock. Best not be late. The summer air show, a parade of jets and prop planes spinning loops up and down the Mississippi, buzzing the tourist steamboats, rattling teeth, was 3 days off, and the practice runs were in high gear by the time Gilpin and Rhonda arrived. We were all back in my living room for the first time since the day of. My home was right on a flight path. The noise was somewhere between jackhammer and avalanche. My cop buddies and I tried to jam a conversation in the spaces between the blasts. Rhonda looked more bird-like than usual, favoring one leg, then another, her head moving all around the room as her gaze alighted on different objects, angles, a magpie looking to line her nest. Gilpin hovered next to her, chewing his lip, tapping a foot. Even the room felt restive. The afternoon sun lit up an atomic flurry of dust motes. A jet shot over the house, that awful sky-rip noise. "Okay, couple of things here," Rhonda said when the silence returned. She and Gilpin sat down as if they both had suddenly decided to stay a while. "Some stuff to get clear on. Some stuff to tell you. All very routine. And as always, if you want a lawyer..." But I knew from my TV shows, my movies, that only guilty guys lawyered up. Real, grieving, worried, innocent husbands did not. "I don't. Thanks," I said. "I actually have some information to share with you. About Amy's former stalker. The guy she dated back in high school."
"Desi, Collins," began Gilpin.
"Collings. I know you all talk to him. I know you, for some reason, aren't that interested in him. So I went to visit him myself today. To make sure he seemed okay. And I don't think he is okay. I think he's someone you all should look into. Really look into. I mean, he moves to St. Louis."
"He was living in St. Louis 3 years before you all moved back," Gilpin said.
"Fine, but he's in St. Louis. Easy drive. Amy bought a gun because she was afraid."
"Desi's okay, Nick. Nice guy," Rhonda said. "Don't you think?"
"He reminds me of you, actually. Real golden boy. Baby of the family."
"I'm a twin, not the baby. I'm actually 3 minutes older."
Rhonda was clearly trying to nip at me, see if she could get a rise. But even knowing this didn't prevent the angry blood flush to my stomach every time she accused me of being a baby.
"Anyway," Gilpin interrupted, "both he and his mother deny that he ever stalked Amy, or that he even had much contact with her these past years except the occasional note."
"My wife would tell you differently. He wrote Amy for years, years. And then he shows up here for the search, Rhonda. Did you know that? He was here that first day. You talked about keeping an eye out for men inserting themselves into the investigation..."
"Desi Collings is not a suspect," she interrupted, one hand up.
"But..."
"Desi Collings is not a suspect," she repeated.
The news stung. I wanted to accuse her of being swayed by Ellen Abbott, but Ellen Abbott was probably best left unmentioned.
"Okay, well, what about all these guys who've clogged up our tip line?"
I walked over and grabbed the sheet of names and numbers that I'd carelessly tossed on the dining room table. I began reading names.
"Inserting themselves into the investigation, David Sampson, Murphy Clark, those are old boyfriends, Tommy O'Hara, that's three calls. Tito Puente, that's just a dumb joke.
Have you phoned any of them back?" Boney asked.
"No, isn't that your job? I don't know which are worthwhile and which are crazies. I don't have time to call some jackass pretending to be Tito Puente."
"I wouldn't put too much emphasis on the tip line, Nick," Rhonda said. "It's kind of a woodwork situation. I mean, we've fielded a lot of phone calls from your old girlfriends. Just want to say hi. See how you are. People are strange."
"Maybe we should get started on our questions," Gilpin nudged.
"Right. Well, I guess we should begin with where you were the morning your wife went missing," Boney said, suddenly apologetic, deferential. She was playing good cop, and we both knew she was playing good cop.
unless she was actually on my side. It seemed possible that sometimes a cop was just on your side, right? When I was at the beach. And you still can't recall anyone seeing you there? Boney asked. It'd help us so much if we could just cross this little thing off our list. She allowed a sympathetic silence. Rhonda could not only keep quiet, she could infuse the room with the mood of her choosing, like an octopus and its ink. Believe me, I'd like that as much as you. But no, I don't remember anyone. Boney smiled a worried smile. It's strange. We've mentioned, just in passing, your being at the beach to a few people. And they all said... they were all surprised. Let's put it that way. Said that didn't sound like you. You aren't a beach guy. I shrugged. I mean, do I go to the beach and lay out all day? No. But to sip my coffee in the morning? Sure. Hey, this might help, Boney said brightly. Where'd you buy your coffee that morning? She turned to Gilpin as if to seek approval. Could tighten the time frame at least, right? I made it here, I said. Oh, she frowned. That's weird, because you don't have any coffee here. Nowhere in the house. I remember thinking it was odd. A caffeine addict notices these things. Right, just something you happened to notice, I thought. I knew a cop named Boney Maroney. Her traps are so obvious, they're clearly phony. I had a leftover cup in the fridge I heated up. I shrugged again. No big deal. Huh. Must have been there a long time. I noticed there's no coffee container in the trash. A few days, still tastes good. We both smiled at each other. I know, and you know. Game on. I actually thought those idiotic words, game on. Yet, I was pleased in a way. The next part was starting. Boney turned to Gilpin, hands on knees, and gave a little nod. Gilpin chewed his lips some more, then finally pointed toward the ottoman, the end table, the living room now righted.
See, here's our problem, Nick, he started. We've seen dozens of home invasions.
Dozens upon dozens upon dozens, Boney interrupted.
Many home invasions. This, all this area right there, in the living room, remember it? The upturned ottoman, the overturned table, the vase on the floor.
He slapped down a photo of the scene in front of me.
This whole area, it was supposed to look like a struggle, right?
My head expanded and snapped back into place. Stay calm.
Supposed to? It looked wrong, Gilpin continued. From the second we saw it. To be honest, the whole thing looked staged. First of all, there's the fact that it was all centered in this one spot. Why wasn't anything messed up anywhere but this room? It's odd.
He proffered another photo, a close-up.
And look here, at this pile of books. They should be in front of the end table. The end table is where they were stacked, right?
I nodded.
So when the end table was knocked over, they should have spilled mostly in front of it, following the trajectory of the falling table. Instead, they're back behind it, as if someone swept them off before knocking over the table.
I stared dumbly at the photo.
And watch this. This is very curious to me, Gilpin continued.
He pointed at three slender antique frames on the mantelpiece. He stomped heavily, and they all flopped face down immediately.
But somehow, they stayed upright through everything else. He showed a photo of the frames upright. I had been hoping, even after they caught my Houston's dinner slip-up, that they were dumb cops, cops from the movies, local rubes aiming to please, trusting the local guy, whatever you say, buddy. I didn't get dumb cops. I don't know what you want me to say, I mumbled. It's totally... I just don't know what to think about this. I just want to find my wife. So do we, Nick. So do we, Rhonda said. But here's another thing. The ottoman, remember how it was flipped upside down? She patted the squatty ottoman, pointed at its four peg legs, each only an inch high. See, this thing is bottom-heavy because of those tiny legs. The cushion practically sits on the floor. Try to push it over. I hesitated. Go on, try it, Boney urged. I gave it a push, but it slid across the carpet instead of turning over. I nodded. I agreed. It was bottom-heavy. Seriously, get down there if you need to and knock that thing upside down, Boney ordered. I knelt down, pushed from lower and lower angles, finally put a hand underneath the ottoman, and flipped it. Even then it lifted up, one side hovering, and fell back into place. I finally had to pick it up and turn it over manually. Weird, huh? Boney said, not sounding all that puzzled. Nick, you do any house cleaning the day your wife went missing? Gilpin asked. No? Okay, because the tech did a luminol sweep, and I'm sorry to tell you, the kitchen floor lit up. A good amount of blood was spilled there. Amy's type. B positive, Boney interrupted. And I'm not talking a little cut. I'm talking blood. Oh, my God. A clot of heat appeared in the middle of my chest. But... Yes, so your wife made it out of this room, Gilpin said. Somehow, in theory, she made it into the kitchen, without disturbing any of those gewgaws on that table just outside the kitchen. And then she collapsed in the kitchen, where she lost a lot of blood. And then someone carefully mopped it up, Rhonda said, watching me. Wait, why would someone try to hide blood but then mess up the living room? We'll figure that out. Don't worry, Nick, Rhonda said quietly. I don't get it. I just don't... Let's sit down, Boney said. She pointed me toward a dining room chair. You eat anything yet? Want a sandwich? Something? I shook my head. Boney was taking turns playing different female characters. Powerful woman, doting caregiver, to see what got the best results. How's your marriage, Nick? Rhonda asked. I mean, 5 years... That's not far from the 7-year itch. The marriage was fine, I repeated. It's fine. Not perfect, but good. Good. She wrinkled her nose. You lie. You think she might have run off? I asked, too hopefully. Made this look like a crime scene and took off? Runaway wife thing? Boney began ticking off reasons no. She hasn't used her cell. She hasn't used her credit cards, ATM cards. She made no major cash withdrawals in the weeks before. And there's the blood, Gilpin added. I mean, again, I don't want to sound harsh, but the amount of blood spilled, that would take some serious... I mean, I couldn't have done it to myself. I'm talking some deep wounds there. Your wife got nerves of steel? Yes,
She does.
She also had a deep phobia of blood, but I'd wait and let the brilliant detectives figure that out.
It seems extremely unlikely, Gilpin said. If she were to wound herself that seriously, why would she mop it up?
So really, let's be honest, Nick, Boney said, leaning over on her knees so she could make eye contact with me as I stared at the floor. How is your marriage currently? We're on your side, but we need the truth. The only thing that makes you look bad is you holding out on us.
We've had bumps.
I saw Amy in the bedroom that last night, her face mottled with the red hivy splotches she got when she was angry. She was spitting out the words, mean, wild words, and I was listening to her, trying to accept the words because they were true. They were technically true. Everything she said.
Describe the bumps for us, Boney said.
Nothing specific, just disagreements. I mean, Amy is a blowstack. She bottles up a bunch of little stuff and boom! But then it's over. We never went to bed angry.
Not Wednesday night? Boney asked.
Never, I lied.
Is it money, what you mostly argue about?
I can't even think what we'd argue about. Just stuff.
What stuff was it the night she went missing? Gilpin said it with a sideways grin, like he'd uttered the most unbelievable gotcha.
Like I told you, there was the lobster.
What else? I'm sure you didn't scream about the lobster for a whole hour.
At that point, Bleeker waddled partway down the stairs and peered through the railings.
Other household stuff, too? Married couple stuff? The cat box? I said. Who would clean the cat box?
You were in a screaming argument about a cat box, Boney said. You know, the principle of the thing. I work a lot of hours, and Amy doesn't, and I think it would be good for her if she did some basic home maintenance, just basic upkeep.
Gilpin jolted like an invalid woken from an afternoon nap. You're an old-fashioned guy, right?
I'm the same way. I tell my wife all the time, I don't know how to iron, I don't know how to do the dishes, I can't cook. So, sweetheart, I'll catch the bad guys. That I can do. And you throw some clothes in the washer now and then. Rhonda, you were married. Did you do the domestic stuff at home?
Boney looked believably annoyed.
I catch bad guys too, idiot.
Gilpin rolled his eyes toward me. I almost expected him to make a joke. Sounds like someone's on the rag. The guy was laying it on so thick.
Gilpin rubbed his Vulpin jaw.
So you just wanted a housewife, he said to me, making the proposition seem reasonable.
I wanted whatever Amy wanted. I really didn't care.
I appealed to Boney now, Detective Rhonda Boney, with a sympathetic air that seemed at least partly authentic.
It's not, I reminded myself.
Amy couldn't decide what to do here. She couldn't find a job and she wasn't interested in the bar, which is fine. If you want to stay home, that's fine, I said. But when she stayed home, she was unhappy too. And she'd wait for me to fix it. It was like I was in charge of her happiness.
Boney said nothing. Gave me a face expressionless as water.
And, I mean, it's fun to be hero for a while, be the white knight, but it doesn't really work for long. I couldn't make her be happy. She didn't want to be happy. So I thought if she started taking charge of a few practical things...
Like the cat box, said Boney,
Yeah, clean the cat box, get some groceries, call a plumber to fix the drip that drove her crazy.
Wow, that sounds like a real happiness plan there. Lot of yucks.
But my point was, do something. Whatever it is, do something. Make the most of the situation. Don't sit and wait for me to fix everything for you.
I was speaking loudly, I realized, and I sounded almost angry, certainly righteous, but it was such a relief. I'd started with a lie, the cat box, and turned that into a surprising burst of pure truth, and I realized why criminals talked too much, because it feels so good to tell your story to a stranger, someone who won't call bullshit, someone forced to listen to your side. Someone pretending to listen to your side, I corrected.
So, the move back to Missouri, Boney said. You moved Amy here against her wishes?
Against her wishes? No. We did what we had to do. I had no job, Amy had no job, my mom was sick. I'd do the same for Amy.
That's nice of you to say, Boney muttered, and suddenly she reminded me exactly of Amy. The damning below-breath retorts uttered at the perfect level, so I was pretty sure I heard them, but couldn't swear to it. And if I asked what I was supposed to ask, what did you say? She'd always say the same thing.
Nothing.
I glared at Boney, my mouth tight. And then I thought, maybe this is part of the plan, to see how you act toward angry, dissatisfied women. I tried to make myself smile, but it only seemed to repulse her more.
And you're able to afford this? Amy working, not working, whatever. You could swing it financially?
Gilpin asked.
We've had some money problems of late, I said. When we first married, Amy was wealthy, like, extremely wealthy.
Right, said Boney. Those amazing Amy books.
Yeah, they made a ton of money in the 80s and 90s, but the publisher dropped them. Said Amy had run her course and everything went south. Amy's parents had to borrow money from us to stay afloat.
From your wife, you mean?
Right, fine. And then we used most of the last of Amy's trust fund to buy the bar, and I've been supporting us since.
So, when you married Amy, she was very wealthy, Gilpin said.
I nodded. I was thinking of the hero narrative, the husband who sticks by his wife through the horrible decline in her family circumstances.
So you had a very nice lifestyle.
Yeah, it was great. It was awesome.
And now she's near broke, and you're dealing with a very different lifestyle than what you married into, what you signed on for.
I realized my narrative was completely wrong.
Because, okay, we've been going over your finances, Nick, and dang, they don't look good.
Gilpin started, almost turning the accusation into a concern, a worry.
The bar's doing decent, I said. It usually takes a new business 3 or 4 years to get out of the red.
It's those credit cards that got my attention, Boney said. $212,000 in credit card debt. I mean, it took my breath away.
She fanned a stack of red ink statements at me. My parents were fanatics about credit cards, used only for special purposes, paid off every month. We don't buy what we can't pay for. It was the Dunn family motto.
I don't think Amy would... Can I see those?
I stuttered, just as a low-flying bomber rattled the window panes. A plant on the mantel promptly lost 5 pretty purple leaves.
Forced into silence for 10 brain-shaking seconds, we all watched the leaves flutter to the ground.
Yet this great brawl we're supposed to believe happened in here, and not a petal was on the floor then, Gilpin muttered disgustedly.
I took the papers from Boney and saw my name, only my name, versions of it. Nick Dunn, Lance Dunn, Lance N. Dunn, Lance Nicholas Dunn, on a dozen different credit cards, balances from $62.78 to $45,602.33, all in various states of lateness, terse threats printed in ominous lettering across the top. Pay now.
Holy fuck! This is like identity theft or something, I said. They're not mine. I mean, freaking look at some of this stuff. I don't even golf.
Someone had paid over $7,000 for a set of clubs.
Anyone can tell you, I really don't golf.
I tried to make it sound self-effacing, yet another thing I'm not good at, but the detectives weren't biting.
You know Noelle Hawthorne? Boney asked. The friend of Amy's you told us to check out?
Wait, I want to talk about the bills, because they are not mine, I said.
I mean, please, seriously, we need to track this down.
We'll track it down, no problem, Boney said, expressionless. Noelle Hawthorne?
Right. I told you to check her out because she's been all over town, wailing about Amy.
Boney arched an eyebrow.
You seem angry about that.
No, like I told you, she seems a little too broken up, like in a fake way. Ostentatious, attention-seeking, a little obsessed.
We talked to Noelle, Boney said. Says your wife was extremely troubled by the marriage, was upset about the money stuff, that she worried you'd married her for her money. She says your wife worried about your temper.
I don't know why Noelle would say that. I don't think she and Amy ever exchanged more than 5 words.
That's funny, because the Hawthorne's living room is covered with photos of Noelle and your wife.
Boney frowned. I frowned, too. Actual, real pictures of her and Amy? Boney continued.
At the St. Louis Zoo last October, on a picnic with the triplets, on a weekend float trip this past June, as in last month.
Amy has never uttered the name Noelle in the entire time we've lived here.
I'm serious.
I scanned my brain over this past June and came upon a weekend I went away with Andy, told Amy I was doing a boys' trip to St. Louis. I'd returned home to find her pink-cheeked and angry, claiming a weekend of bad cable and bored reading on the dock.
And she was on a float trip?
No. I couldn't think of anything Amy would care for less than the typical Midwestern float trip. Beers bobbing in coolers tied to canoes, loud music, drunk frat boys, campgrounds dotted with vomit.
Are you sure it was my wife in those photos?
They gave each other a he's serious look.
Nick, Boney said, we have no reason to believe that the woman in the photos who looks exactly like your wife and who Noelle Hawthorne, a mother of three, your wife's best friend here in town, says is your wife, is not your wife.
Your wife who, I should say, according to Noelle, you married for money, Gilpin added.
I'm not joking, I said. Anyone these days can doctor photos on a laptop.
Okay, so a minute ago you were sure Desi Collings was involved, and now you've moved on to Noelle Hawthorne, Gilpin said. It seems like you're really casting about for someone to blame.
Besides me? Yes, I am. Look, I did not marry Amy for her money. You really should talk more with Amy's parents. They know me. They know my character.
They don't know everything, I thought, my stomach seizing. Boney was watching me. She looked sort of sorry for me. Gilpin didn't even seem to be listening.
You bumped up the life insurance coverage on your wife to 1.2 million, Gilpin said with mock weariness. He even pulled a hand over his long, thin-jawed face.
Amy did that herself, I said quickly.
The cops both just looked at me and waited.
I mean, I filed the paperwork, but it was Amy's idea. She insisted. I swear I couldn't care less, but Amy said, she said given the change in her income, it made her feel more secure or something, or it was a smart business decision. Fuck, I don't know. I don't know why she wanted it. I didn't ask her to.
2 months ago, someone did a search on your laptop, Boney continued. Body float Mississippi River. Can you explain that? I took two deep breaths. 9 seconds to pull myself together. God, that was just a dumb book idea, I said. I was thinking about writing a book.
Huh,
Boney replied. Look, here's what I think is happening, I began. I think a lot of people watch these news programs where the husband is always this awful guy who kills his wife, and they are seeing me through that lens, and some really innocent, normal things are being twisted. This is turning into a witch hunt.
That's how you explain those credit card bills? Gilpin asked.
I told you I can't explain the fucking credit card bills because I have nothing to do with them. It's your fucking job to figure out where they came from.
They sat silent, side by side, waiting.
What is currently being done to find my wife? I asked. What leads are you exploring besides me?
The house began shaking. The sky ripped, and through the back window, we could see a jet shooting past, right over the river, buzzing us.
F-10, Rhonda said.
Nah, too small, Gilpin said. It's got to be.
It's an F-10.
Boney leaned toward me, hands entwined.
It's our job to make sure you are in the 100% clear, Nick, she said. I know you want that too. Now if you can just help us out with the few little tangles, because that's what they are, they keep tripping us up.
Maybe it's time I got a lawyer. The cops exchanged another look, as if they'd settled a bet.
Amy Elliott Dunn, October 21st, 2011. Diary entry. Nick's mom is dead. I haven't been able to write because Nick's mom is dead, and her son has come unmoored. Sweet, tough Maureen. She was up and moving around until days before she died, refusing to discuss any sort of slowdown. I just want to live until I can't anymore, she said. She'd gotten into knitting caps for other chemo patients. She herself was done after one round, no interest in prolonging life if it meant more tubes. So I'll remember her always surrounded by bright knots of wool, red and yellow and green, and her fingers moving, the needles click-clacking while she talked in her contented cat voice, all deep, sleepy purr. And then, one morning in September, she woke, but didn't really wake, didn't become Maureen. She was a bird-size woman overnight, that fast, all wrinkles and shell, her eyes darting around the room, unable to place anything, including herself. So then came the hospice, a gently lit, cheerful place, with paintings of women in bonnets and rolling hills of bounty, and snack machines and small coffees. The hospice was not expected to fix her or help her, but just to make sure she died comfortably. And just 3 days later, she did. Very matter-of-fact, the way Maureen would have wanted it. Although I'm sure she would have rolled her eyes at that phrase, the way Maureen would have wanted it. Her wake was modest but nice, with hundreds of people. Her look-alike sister from Omaha bustling by proxy, pouring coffee and Baileys and handing out cookies and telling funny stories about Mo. We buried her on a gusty, warm morning, Go and Nick leaning into each other as I stood nearby, feeling intrusive. That night in bed, Nick let me put my arms around him, his back to me. But after a few minutes, he got up, whispered, "Got to get some air," and left the house. His mother had always mothered him. She insisted on coming by once a week and ironing for us, and when she was done ironing, she'd say, "I'll just help tidy." And after she'd left, I'd look in the fridge and find she'd peeled and sliced his grapefruit for him, put the pieces in a snap-top container, and then I'd open the bread and discover all the crusts had been cut away, each slice returned half-naked. I am married to a 34-year-old man who is still offended by bread crusts. But I tried to do the same those first weeks after his mom passed. I snipped the bread crusts. I ironed his T-shirts. I baked a blueberry pie from his mom's recipe.
"I don't need to be babied, really, Amy," he said as he stared at the loaf of skinned breads. "I let my mom do it because it made her happy. But I know you don't like that nurturing stuff."
So we're back to black squares. Sweet, doting, loving Nick is gone. Gruff, peeved, angry Nick is back. You are supposed to lean on your spouse in hard times, but Nick seems to have gone even farther away. He is a mama's boy whose mama is dead. He doesn't want anything to do with me. He uses me for sex when he needs to. He presses me against a table or over the back of the bed and fucks me, silent until the last few moments, those few quick grunts, and then he releases me. He puts a palm on the small of my back, his one gesture of intimacy, and he says something that is supposed to make it seem like a game.
"You're so sexy, sometimes I can't control myself."
But he says it in a dead voice. Quiz. Your husband, with whom you once shared a wonderful sex life, has turned distant and cold. He only wants sex his way on his time. You, A, withhold sex further. He's not going to win this game. B, cry and whine and demand answers he's not yet ready to give, further alienating him. C, have faith that this is just a bump in a long marriage. He is in a dark place. So try to be understanding and wait it out. Answer, C. Right? It bothers me that my marriage is disintegrating and I don't know what to do. You'd think my parents, the double psychologists, would be the obvious people to talk to, but I have too much pride. They would not be good for marital advice. They are soulmates, remember? They are all peaks, no valleys, a single infinite burst of marital ecstasy. I can't tell them I am screwing up the one thing I have left, my marriage. They'd somehow write another book, a fictional rebuke in which Amazing Amy celebrated the most fantastic, fulfilling, bump-free little marriage ever. Because she put her mind to it. But I worry. All the time. I know I'm already too old for my husband's tastes. Because I used to be his ideal, 6 years ago. And so I've heard his ruthless comments about women nearing 40, how pathetic he finds them, overdressed, out at bars, oblivious to their lack of appeal. He'd come back from a night out drinking, and I'd ask him how the bar was, whatever bar, and he'd so often say, "Totally inundated by lost causes." His code for women my age. At the time, a girl barely in her 30s, I'd smirked along with him as if that would never happen to me. Now, I am his lost cause, and he's trapped with me. And maybe that's why he's so angry. I've been indulging in toddler therapy. I walk over to Noelle's every day, and I let her triplets paw at me. The little plump hands in my hair, the sticky breath on my neck. You can understand why women always threaten to devour children. She is just to eat. I could eat him with a spoon. Although watching her three children toddle to her, sleep-stained from their nap, rubbing their eyes while they make their way to Mama, little hands touching her knee or arm as if she were home base, as if they knew they were safe, it hurts me sometimes to watch. Yesterday, I had a particularly needful afternoon at Noelle's, so maybe that's why I did something stupid. Nick comes home and finds me in the bedroom, fresh from a shower, and pretty soon he is pushing me against the wall, pushing himself inside me. When he is done and releases me, I can see the wet kiss of my mouth against the blue paint. As he sits on the edge of the bed, panting, he says,
"Sorry about that. I just needed you."
Not looking at me. I go to him and put my arms around him, pretending what we'd just done was normal, a pleasant marital ritual, and I say, "I've been thinking."
"Yeah, what's that?"
"Well, now might be the right time to start a family, try to get pregnant." I know it's crazy even as I say it, but I can't help myself. I have become the crazy woman who wants to get pregnant because it will save her marriage. It's humbling to become the very thing you once mocked. He jerks away from me.
"Now? Now is about the worst time to start a family, Amy. You have no job."
I know, but I'd want to stay home with the baby anyway at first.
"My mom just died, Amy."
"And this would be new life, a new start." He grips me by both arms and looks me right in the eye for the first time in a week.
"Amy, I think you think that now that my mom is dead, we'll just frolic back to New York and have some babies, and you'll get your old life back. But we don't have enough money. We barely have enough money for the two of us to live here. You can't imagine how much pressure I feel every day to fix this mess we're in. To fucking provide. I can't handle you and me and a few kids. You'll want to give them everything you had growing up, and I can't. No private schools for the little duns. No tennis and violin lessons. No summer homes. You'd hate how poor we'd be. You'd hate it."
"I'm not that shallow, Nick."
"You really think we're in a great place right now to have kids?"
It is the closest we've gotten to discussing our marriage, and I can see he already regrets saying something. "We're under a lot of pressure, baby," I say. "We've had a few bumps, and I know a lot of it is my fault. I just feel so at loose ends here.
So we're going to be one of those couples who has a kid to fix their marriage? Because that always works out so well.
We'll have a baby because... His eyes go dark, canine, and he grabs me by the arms again.
Just... No, Amy. Not right now. I can't take one more bit of stress. I can't handle one more thing to worry about. I am cracking under the pressure. I will snap.
For once, I know he's telling the truth.
Nick Dunn. 6 days gone. The first 48 hours are key in any investigation. Amy had been gone now almost a week. A candlelight vigil would be held this evening in Tom Sawyer Park, which, according to the press, was a favorite place of Amy Elliott Dunn's. I'd never known Amy to set foot in the park. Despite the name, it is not remotely quaint. Generic, bereft of trees, with a sandbox that's always full of animal feces, it is utterly un-Twainy. In the last 24 hours, the story had gone national. It was everywhere, just like that. God bless the faithful Elliots. Mary Beth phoned me last night as I was trying to recover from the bombshell police interrogation. My mother-in-law had seen the Ellen Abbott show and pronounced the woman an opportunistic ratings whore. Nevertheless, we'd spent most of today strategizing how to handle the media. The media, my former clan, my people, was shaping its story, and the media loved the Amazing Amy angle and the long-married Elliots. No snarky commentary on the dismantling of the series or the author's near bankruptcy. Right now, it was all hearts and flowers for the Elliots. The media loved them. Me, not so much. The media was already turning up items of concern. Not only the stuff that had been leaked, my lack of alibi, the possibly staged crime scene, but actual personality traits. They reported that back in high school, I'd never dated one girl longer than a few months, and thus was clearly a ladies' man. They found out we had my father in Comfort Hill, and that I rarely visited, and thus I was an ingrate dad abandoner. "It's a problem. They don't like you," Go said after every bit of news coverage. "It's a real, real problem, Lance." The media had resurrected my first name, which I'd hated since grade school, stifled at the start of every school year when the teacher called roll, "It's Nick. I go by Nick." Every September, an opening day write, "Nick. I go by Nick." Always some smart-ass kid would spend recess parading around like a mincing gallant. "Hi, I'm Lance," in a flowy, shirted voice. Then it would be forgotten again until the following year. But not now. Now it was all over the news. The dreaded three-name judgment reserved for serial killers and assassins. Lance Nicholas Dunn. And there was no one I could interrupt. Rand and Mary Beth Elliott, Go and I, carpooled to the vigil together. It was unclear how much information the Elliots were receiving, how many damning updates about their son-in-law. I knew they were aware of the staged scene.
"I'm going to get some of my own people in there, and they'll tell us just the opposite. That it clearly was the scene of a struggle," Rand said confidently. "The truth is malleable. You just need to pick the right expert."
Rand didn't know about the other stuff. The credit cards and the life insurance and the blood and Noel, my wife's bitter best friend with the damning claims, abuse, greed, fear. She was booked on Ellen Abbott tonight, post-vigil. Noelle and Ellen could be mutually disgusted by me for the viewing audience. Not everyone was repulsed by me. In the past week, the bar's business was booming. Hundreds of customers passed